The Tom Woods Show, episode 562.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hello and happy new year, everybody. Welcome to another year of episodes of The Tom Woods Show. Turns out I've been called out of town for about a week. Well, called out of town makes it sound more professional than it really is. It's more or less a surprise pleasure trip I'm going to be taking to New York City for about a week. So that means I have, of course, what else? Prepared a whole bunch of episodes for you in my absence. The first one today is going to involve JFK, as you can see from the title. I've got a whole bunch of topics with a whole bunch of great guests coming up this week and the beginning of next week, so don't miss any of them. They're going to be super and great. I want to also tell you, after the episode today, or after the meat of it, make sure you don't switch it off, because I've got a couple of neat things to tell you about, brand new neat things that I really, really make sure you will stay tuned and listen to. You're going to be glad, believe me, you're going to be glad you stayed tuned to listen to them. All right, let's talk about what we're going to cover here today. The JFK topic comes up a lot because there are people in Ron Paul circles or Alex Jones circles or, heaven help us, Webster Tarpley circles who think JFK was really a good guy. You know, he was a good guy, and that's why the bad guys assassinated him. And I guess I just don't get this yearning to find the good president who was standing up for the people. There just ain't no such thing. There is this myth, for instance, that Woodrow Wilson later regretted helping to establish the Federal Reserve, and he says that he's a most unhappy man because he's handed over his country to the bankers or whatever. He never said this. That's a phony baloney quote. Or they stitch together some things that Wilson said on different occasions and smush them together to create a quotation that really is not reflective of his beliefs. Wilson remained very proud of creating the Federal Reserve. That's a phony baloney quotation. And I think most libertarians, when they hear it, think, oh, come on, that's give me a break. That's so obviously fake. But for some reason, there's a sliver of people out there who want to believe in this myth of the good president who was just looking out for the interests of the people. And so they latch on in a kind of hero worship to people like Woodrow Wilson and John Kennedy. And I'm sorry to burst their bubbles, but in a way, I'm not sorry. Stop believing. This is juvenile. Stop believing this stuff. Why do you feel you need to find this good president? Just isn't it better to just face the world the way it really is? That's my view. Face the world the way it really is. There ain't no Woodrow Wilson coming to rescue you. Woodrow Wilson, of all people, coming to rescue you? Woodrow Wilson, who screwed up the country beyond repair 100 years ago? He ain't coming to rescue nobody. So forget that. Just get that right out of your head. Well, likewise, the John F. Kennedy thing has developed for a number of reasons, but one of them is this claim that Kennedy was actually anti-Fed, if you can believe that. The claim is that this establishment man of the Eastern establishment, JFK, was anti-Federal Reserve. The chances of that being true are basically zero. Why would any member of the establishment be opposed to the Federal Reserve? There's no such thing. That does not happen. And the evidence, if we can call it that, that's been adduced for this is this claim that he issued an executive order involving the printing of silver certificates, and this was a deliberate attempt to undermine the Federal Reserve. Well, what I'm going to do on the show notes page today, which of course is tomwoods.com/562, is I'm going to link you to an impeccable source on this question, and that's G. Edward Griffin. G. Edward Griffin, as most listeners will know, is the author of what a lot of us consider to be really a definitive work on the Federal Reserve called The Creature from Jekyll Island. And in that book, which so many of these supporters of the JFK myth have read and they claim to be big fans of G. Edward Griffin, they apparently skipped over his section on JFK, where he says this whole thing's a myth that JFK was assassinated because he was undermining the Fed. He was not undermining the Fed. He was not assassinated for that reason. And as I note in this very episode, JFK was obviously a big fan of the Fed. He was very glad about the Federal Reserve's expansionary monetary policy of the 1960s. That was a big part of his overall approach to the economy. He would have no interest whatsoever in undermining it. There is absolutely nothing to any of this. So I'm going to link you to what G. Edward Griffin had to say on this particular topic with all the details. And that's at tomwoods.com/562. So sorry to burst your bubble, but it's one of these sorry, not sorry situations. So what I'm actually doing for you today, certainly this is not going to be true of all the episodes while I'm gone. All the other episodes are going to have guests on a whole bunch of different topics. But for this episode, I'm actually reproducing for you a talk I give on JFK and the 1960s at libertyclassroom.com, which I'm often telling you about. So here's a little sample of some stuff that I teach over there. You can join libertyclassroom.com and be a very happy person learning the history and economics they didn't teach you. In the next week or so, we're going to be putting up the first few lectures of our 15th course, this one by Bob Murphy, on the history of economic thought, which is a great way to learn a lot of economics, by the way. You learn what people got right and what people got wrong, and Bob is the guy to do it, so that's going to be great. He's added to our faculty this year. It's really thrilling. So course number 15 is going up. And as you can see, you listen to these on the go. You can watch them if you like to watch things. Bob has PowerPoint presentations and stuff. But and then you can ask us all the questions you want. It's super great. LibertyClassroom.com. I have a secret page, LibertyClassroom.com/coupons. Sort of secret page. Not that secret if I'm coming right out and telling you about it, right? LibertyClassroom.com/coupons will give you coupon codes. So you can, you know, save some dough. So here we go, a little bit stuff on JFK, and maybe in the next few weeks I'll give you another free sample from Liberty Classroom. That'll be me talking about the 1970s. Oh boy, a lot of fun in the 1970s, if by fun you mean total misery. All right, here we go. Hope you enjoy. Remember, stay tuned at the end because I got some fun things to tell you. Today we're going to talk about John F. Kennedy, who was elected president in 1960 and served until his assassination in late 1963. And I'd like to begin with a little background about Kennedy because it's quite interesting information. And here I'm very much indebted to the work of Paul Johnson, who summarizes a lot of these important and interesting tidbits about Kennedy's early life in his book, A History of the American People. And I would just point out as a cautionary note, that's not a perfect book, far from it. I was disappointed years ago when that Johnson book came out because I read his great book, Modern Times, The World from the 20s to the 80s, which was a great book. It's a great book before he made it into The World from the 20s to the 90s, which actually made it a much worse book. The first version of Modern Times was a great book, so I expected a great history of the U.S. from Johnson. We didn't really get it. There's a lot of very conventional stuff in it. But he is good on a good many issues all the same, and one of them is the summarizing of what really went on in Kennedy's early political life. So I want to start there. Kennedy really was a carefully manufactured product for public consumption. His Harvard thesis from his days in college was written by a small team, including his father's speechwriter and a writer for the New York Times. It later appeared in book form as Why England Slept. Kennedy had the good fortune of being the son of Joseph Kennedy, an influential and wealthy man who had made quite a bit of money in a great many areas, not least of them, bootleg liquor. But he also served as ambassador to London and traveled in influential circles. And his wealth and influence allowed him to propel his son into the political spotlight using means that were unavailable to the average person. The book Why England Slept, by Kennedy, putatively, became a bestseller, largely thanks to the fact that Joe was able to buy tens of thousands of copies and just store them in the family's sort of getaway home in Maine. Kennedy's later book, Profiles in Courage, was likewise assembled by a team led by Ted Sorensen, the presidential speechwriter. A heavy lobbying campaign by Joe Kennedy and his friends managed to win the Pulitzer Prize for that book for Kennedy, and good luck if you tried to claim in public that Kennedy's book had been ghostwritten, because Joe would hit you with a libel suit, and with Joe's prodding, the FBI would start snooping around your personal effects. His father invested tremendous sums to launch
John, or as he was known, Jack's political career. So his first race was for U.S. House of Representatives in 1946. And during that House race, large families were paid $50 each to, quote, help out at the polls. And Tip O'Neill, some of you who are my age or older will remember, was the Speaker of the U.S. House under Ronald Reagan. Tip O'Neill said they were simply buying votes a few at a time, and $50 was a lot of money. Paul Johnson says that to get Jack into the Senate, Joe diverted one rival into the governorship race by making a large campaign contribution, gave another to Adlai Stevenson to buy his endorsement, and lent the editor of the Boston Post $500,000 to secure his support. And John Kennedy himself said, "You know, we had to buy that paper, or we'd have been licked." Joe's sights, though, ultimately were set on the presidency, and James McGregor Burns was employed to write a very favorable biography of Jack Kennedy called John F. Kennedy, A Political Profile. Other writers ghost-wrote a bunch of articles for Kennedy that appeared in Kennedy's name in a variety of influential periodicals, both popular and scholarly, to give the impression of Kennedy as a deep thinker, a would-be scholar president. Joe met with the well-known Chicago mob boss, the mafia figure Sam Giancana, who bought off election officials in exchange for assurances of federal sympathy if JFK were elected. And in fact, Judith Exner, who was the mistress that Kennedy and Giancana shared in common, Giancana told Exner, "Listen, honey, if it wasn't for me, your boyfriend wouldn't even be in the White House." There were all kinds of apparent irregularities in the election results of 1960 between Kennedy and had been Vice President Richard Nixon, Vice President under Eisenhower, but Nixon, for a variety of reasons, refused to demand an investigation. I mean, he claimed, one of the reasons he gave was that it simply would not be good for the country, and he simply seethed and moved on. Now, a little something about policy. For one thing, Kennedy had run on the issue of the so-called missile gap, that the Eisenhower administration, which Nixon presumably had to answer for, had allowed a missile gap between the United States and the Soviet Union to develop, and Kennedy was going to fill in that missile gap and never allow such a thing to take place again. Now, Kennedy knew full well there was no missile gap, there was a missile gap, but it was in the United States' favor. He knew that. He knew that Nixon couldn't disclose this because then that would reveal the extent of U.S. spy and intelligence operations in the Soviet Union. They were knowledgeable about the extent of the Soviet arsenal. So Kennedy got away with promoting the idea of the missile gap. And once he was in office, he actually laughed and said, "Whoever believed in the missile gap anyway?" Well, policy regarding the military, though, we need to talk about Kennedy's slogan, flexible response, which really was a slogan that he had gotten from General Maxwell Taylor, the four-star general who had written a 1960 book called The Uncertain Trumpet. It was a bestseller. And Taylor was trying to argue that the policy adopted by Eisenhower was really inadequate. He said that it was not enough to either threaten all-out nuclear war on the one hand or simply to engage in covert operations on the other. A revivified army was necessary if you were going to be able to do everything in between. And of course, Taylor was in the army, so of course he's making an appeal for his branch here, but made a strategic and theoretical argument for what he was saying. He said that the Eisenhower strategy of massive retaliation was really offering the United States only two choices. In his words, the initiation of general nuclear war or compromise and retreat. He thought that there should be a broader array of responses that the president and the federal government could choose from, hence the term flexible response. He said the United States needed the capability to, quote, react across the entire spectrum of possible challenge. And Kennedy adopted this theme in his campaign. Now, he wound up dramatically increasing spending on both conventional and nuclear forces. He wasn't neglecting the nuclear option, but he was going to increase spending on all options. The White House also reasserted authority over national security that had begun to drift into the hands of the Strategic Air Command and the CIA, as we talked about when we looked at Eisenhower. Kennedy's really going to re-centralize this decision-making power in the hands of the White House once again. One of the significant events, foreign policy-wise, under JFK was the Bay of Pigs invasion, so-called Bay of Pigs invasion. Under Eisenhower, the CIA had planned to overthrow the Cuban leader Fidel Castro using 1,400 Cuban exiles who had been trained by the CIA. The invasion, it was hoped, would incite a massive uprising against the Castro regime. It was thought that it was undesirable to have a communist regime so close to the mainland United States. Now, JFK decided to go ahead with it, but he said there would be no U.S. forces committed if things went awry. This is April 1961. Well, it's indeed a complete failure, and it's a humiliation for Kennedy. And so with that humiliation, he feels like there's some political pressure on him now to do something. So it's not at all uncommon in the history of U.S. politics, or really the politics of any country, that sometimes foreign policy initiatives are undertaken because of domestic policy, domestic pressures. The sense is the president needs to look strong, to do something, to recover from some previous gaffe or misstep. So getting Castro suddenly became an obsession. So-called Operation Mongoose involved all kinds of bizarre ways of killing him, none of which turned out to be successful. Meanwhile, Cuba had a mere 6 million people. It had one-fifth the per capita income of the United States and a negligible military. So it was really very much a question why there was this obsession with it. Well, Castro, as a result of all this, naturally enough, finally came to the conclusion that his regime was in serious danger, and he repeatedly urged assistance from the Soviet Union, with which he already had a cordial relationship, but nothing anywhere near the close relationship he would form after the perceived threats to his regime from the United States developed. So by May 1962, Khrushchev was becoming more and more sympathetic to having a much closer relationship with Castro's Cuba, and that assistance included nuclear missiles in Cuba. Now, publicly, when it was discovered that these missiles were in Cuba, the United States had taken aerial photographs and could see that there were offensive weapons in Cuba, these nuclear missiles. Kennedy publicly said, well, these missiles in Cuba are a provocation that came out of the blue. But it's interesting to note that privately, Kennedy noted the connection between, on the one hand, efforts to overthrow Castro and the presence of U.S. nuclear missiles in Turkey on the one hand, and the missiles in Cuba on the other, in effect acknowledging that Castro and Khrushchev were more or less doing what Kennedy himself would have done in their position. So what Kennedy decided to do was not to launch an all-out nuclear attack on the Soviet Union, but to proceed somewhat more gingerly by choosing a quarantine that would around Cuba that would prevent the introduction of any additional offensive weapons into Cuba, and that any Soviet ships containing such weapons, he said, would simply be turned back. The crisis was ultimately resolved when Khrushchev removed the missiles from Cuba. But unknown to the world, because Kennedy insisted on it not being known, was Kennedy's pledge that the United States would not invade Cuba, and his pledge to remove the missiles from Turkey. So with both sides more or less conceding something, the world stepped back from the brink. And we have this exchange of letters between Khrushchev and Kennedy, and it's quite interesting to note both men's state of mind and what they were perceiving as these events unfolded. And Khrushchev said to Kennedy at one point that you and I are like two men pulling on a rope with a knot in the middle, and the more we pull on it, the tighter the knot gets. What if we both loosened up on the rope? Maybe we might be able to untie the knot. And that's, in fact, essentially what happened. Now, domestically, that was, of course, the most spectacular example of a foreign policy event during the Kennedy years. There was, of course, the the building of the Berlin Wall in 1961, dividing East and West Berlin and preventing East Berliners from getting out and fleeing to the Free West. But strictly speaking, the Soviets had not interfered with Western access rights and Western access to West Berlin. So that there was nothing really that Kennedy could do about that. That was an incident that Kennedy more or less had to live with, had to be upset about, but short of a full-fledged invasion, there was nothing he was going to be able to do about the Berlin Wall other than moral protests of one type or another that were made over the years. But domestically, again, quoting Johnson, the Kennedys snooped into the tax returns of private citizens, wiretapped distinguished reporters, a congressman, Martin Luther King, and perhaps others, and prodded the IRS to investigate the tax-exempt status of groups they considered ideologically obnoxious. In other words, the Kennedys were no different from any other president, John Kennedy and his brother, Attorney General Robert Kennedy. They were no different from any of the others for all the media insinuations of the contrary about the sanctity and saintliness of these men. They were pretty much the same as anybody else when it came to the use of and abuse of presidential powers. What's interesting to note domestically about Kennedy is not so much the various programs that he got passed, because those were relatively few. It was really going to be his vice president, Lyndon Johnson, who succeeded him in 1963 and then was reelected in 1964 in a landslide, that we would see the Kennedy and then a much, much larger legislative agenda of Lyndon Johnson actually implemented. It's more subtle. What happened domestically. It's not like a bunch of legislation like you see in the New Deal under FDR or the Great Society and War and Poverty under LBJ. It's more subtle than that. It's the growth in the 1960s of what became known as the New Economics. It was taking the ideas of John Maynard Keynes, the economist who had written his famous General Theory of Employment, Interest, and Money in 1936, and really broadening and expanding them. It had been the view of Keynes that capitalist economies were chronically given to unemployment or underemployment of resources. And so what you needed was a great helmsman that could steer the capitalist economy, particularly at moments of crisis or depression. They could not correct themselves or would not correct themselves promptly enough. And so there was therefore need for some type of government intervention, additional government spending, stimulus of that sort of kind, monetary stimulus as well, creating additional money, pumping that into the economy to get the thing going again. Well, in the 1960s, you got economists who were going beyond this. And here I want to quote authors John Macon and Norman Ornstein, who said, "The young liberal economists around Kennedy were interested not just in avoiding depression and unemployment. They began to see Keynes's ideas as the basis for a magic formula that could be used to create growth and prosperity by government fiat." And they were really getting these ideas from Alvin Hansen and Abba Lerner, who were followers of Keynes. Hansen was the most famous American follower of Keynes. And they were arguing that there was a concept called potential output, which refers to the quantity of goods and services that can be produced when all resources in the country, including labor, are fully employed. That's our potential output. This is what we can produce when we use up all our productive capacity. But when laborers are unemployed, we're not using all our productive capacity. So now there's a gap developing between how much we could produce if everything were being employed and how much we actually are producing. And this is called the output gap. How do we fill in that output gap? Well, through Keynesian stimulus measures. We gotta spend money. We gotta have the government spend money, and that'll put these people to work, and so we won't have this output gap any longer. So it's not enough to just wait for crises and then try to solve the crises through stimulus. We need to guide the economy at all times, having just the right amount of spending and taxes to regulate total spending in the economy to keep things moving, so that we're always at potential output and no output gap has a chance to develop. So the view, in other words, is that unemployment is always some kind of market failure that can be corrected by the actions of governments. And if it's not corrected by the actions of governments, then we're suffering an output gap that's making us poorer. So what's the reason for not intervening? We've got to intervene. So this means running deficits, and it means Federal Reserve inflation of the money supply. Kennedy, in August 1962, very revealingly said this: "Everybody talks about our deficit. Everyone wants us to cut spending. They don't seem to understand that it's the deficit, the spending, that's keeping the economy pumped up. I love that deficit." Unquote. Now, we'll talk about, if you like, the economic ideas behind this and whether they were wise or unwise in our discussion forums. Right now, I just want you to be aware this is something that's developing in the 1960s. It hasn't really been noticed all that much. So deficit spending as a policy, as an ongoing fiscal policy to steer the economy, to keep an output gap from developing, to keep employment high, the argument being that somehow this contributes to employment. That's, of course, a debatable statement. And then also the increase in the money supply, the so-called M2 measure of the amount of money in the economy during the Kennedy years was growing at 8% a year. And I compare that with 3.6% a year during the 1950s. And if you go back to 1945, you go 1945 to 1960, it was growing at 3.3% a year. So there's a huge growth in the rate of growth of the money supply during the Kennedy years. Now, what accounts for this shift in the policy of the Federal Reserve? Well, economist Joe Salerno, whose great book chapter I'm assigning you for your reading, if you have time and you like, along with this lecture, says this. He says, the answer is Kennedy and his new economists, who conducted a relentless and incessant campaign for easy money from the very beginning of his administration. This campaign took the form of repeated public utterances on the part of the president and his economic advisors, as well as direct presidential pressure on William McChesney Martin, who was chairman of the Fed under Eisenhower and continued in that position until 1970. I was not known as a particularly bright or effective guy, I might add to that. So much for the idea that the Fed is this independent agency and it operates in this ethereal platonic sphere apart from the mundane concerns of this world. As it turns out to be, not quite like that. There's a lot of room for presidential pressure. Now, Kennedy, meanwhile, is trying to obscure the connection between money growth and price growth, to try to claim that maybe there's something else that's causing prices to go up, other than the fact that we've turned on the money spigot. So in his State of the Union message in 1962, Kennedy said, "Our first line of defense against inflation is the good sense and public spirit of business and labor, keeping their total increases in wages and profits in line with productivity." So again, suggesting that, well, don't look at us, don't look at the Fed or the government for the explanation of why prices are going up. It's business and labor that raises prices. We just got to keep them in line. Salerno also says, Kennedy and key members of his administration also doggedly prodded the Fed, both privately and publicly, to ease monetary policy, even threatening to terminate its independent status if it did not acquiesce. As early as his campaign for the presidency, Kennedy expressed his disappointment with the Fed's tendency to resort to restrictive monetary policy to rein in inflation, and his intention to break with such a policy. In 1962, Kennedy petitioned Congress for a revision of the terms of the Fed chairmanship that would enable each president to nominate a new chairman at the beginning of his term. In the Wall Street Journal in the 1990s, Susan Lee, an author, wrote this: "Keynesians were always hectoring the Fed to be a little looser in providing money to the economy and hectoring business and workers to hold down prices and wages. In other words, at the same time they were encouraging inflation with a loose monetary policy, they were trying to limit its impact by forbidding management and labor to cope." Well, then perhaps the most, outside of matters pertaining to civil rights, the most dramatic domestic episode of the Kennedy years, somewhat related to this, is the steel crisis, which began in August 1961, when economic advisor Walter Heller sent a memo to Kennedy saying that a steel strike, or a sharp rise in the price of steel, or steel workers' wages, or both, was the single greatest threat to economic stability during Kennedy's presidency. Well, so Kennedy wrote an open letter to the steel companies: don't raise the price of steel. It's your patriotic duty not to raise the price of steel. The Council on Economic Advisors around Kennedy had calculated that wage increases that had recently been negotiated in the steel industry could be absorbed by the steel firms without a price increase in steel. They could afford it without raising prices. But steel prices had not increased since the recession year of 1958. Recession years, things tend to fall in price. They hadn't risen since then, even though cost pressures had been building on the steel industry, and their average rate of return on equity had been substantially low, the average for U.S. manufacturing since that year. So February 1962, Kennedy starts lobbying. He wants to lobby both sides to initiate early negotiations for a new industry-wide contract to go into effect the middle of the year to hold the line on basically everything. No price increases, certainly, but only modest wage increases. So he's not taking either, he's not saying that the workers should get absolutely everything, not saying they should get absolutely nothing, but there should be a measured response, a maybe modest wage increase. And Kennedy took the fact that the steel firm said nothing about price increases as a kind of implicit promise not to raise prices, but they never made any such promise. So when, in fact, price increases were announced in early April of 1962, Kennedy was absolutely furious. They were raising price about 3.5%. Kennedy said these price increases would be, quote, inflationary. So again, the idea that inflation is caused by businesses raising prices. In the discussion section, we can talk about what causes price inflation. Is it businesses raising prices or is it something else? Kennedy found out that the next day after he heard about the first steel company raising prices, that another five companies were raising their prices. And so Kennedy just engaged in an all-out rhetorical assault on the steel industry in a major press conference and calling them every name in the book and calling them unpatriotic for doing this to their country. He armed journalists who were friendly to the administration with loaded questions that they could use at steel firm's press conference. Kennedy was upset that the NBC Nightly News seemed to him to be too much in favor of the steel companies. So Kennedy actually called up the chairman of the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, and said, look, I thought they were supposed to be our friends. I want you to do something about that. You do something about that. So Kennedy was really using everything he had. The defense secretary was ordering defense contractors to shift their purchases to companies that hadn't raised their prices. Measures like that were being taken, various programs, the submarine program was given entirely to a small steel company that hadn't engaged in the price increases. Walter Heller estimated that the government used so much steel that it could shift maybe 9%, just the government alone could shift 9% of the industry's total business away from the six companies, the half dozen companies that were guilty of raising their prices. So all kinds of things were being done. FBI agents were calling steel executives in the middle of the night. They were showing up at the reporters' doors at 3 o'clock in the morning. They wanted their notes from that they had taken when they covered the stockholders' meeting of Bethlehem Steel. There was a price fixing accusation that was made by the Federal Trade Commission. There's some evidence that there were threats of IRS audits of expense accounts of these companies. So finally, by April 13th, just a few days later, one steel company after another began announcing they were rescinding the price increases, and that was the end of it. But this was certainly quite a significant move by Kennedy in terms of the involvement of the president directly in the economy, with a decision that it seems like a private company is within its rights to make, that is deciding on what the price of its product will be. Now, as I say, domestically otherwise, you can see some things Kennedy did, like he raised the minimum wage and a few things of that nature. But things like a full-scale war on poverty did not occur under Kennedy. Kennedy wanted a poverty bill introduced toward the end of his presidency. He had read the famous Harrington book, The Other America, which some people say had a great influence on what later became the war on poverty at the federal level. And he had read that, was very moved by it, wanted to do something at the federal level to fight poverty. The subject of poverty was becoming very politically chic at that time, but he never was able to do it. And as with so many other things during the Kennedy term, they would come to fruition only in the presidential tenure of his successor, Lyndon Johnson.
All right, that is that. But remember I told you I had a couple of things to tell you. Well, big fun thing is coming in just a minute, but almost as fun things are coming right now. A couple of websites started by your fellow Tom Woods Show listeners. And they look pretty good to me. And one of them is Seeking Contributors. So here's an opportunity to get your feet wet. If you've been meaning to write online, and heaven forbid you don't have your own blog yet, here's a great invitation and opportunity. And the site is libertarianwingmedia.com. And I just looked at it, and it's got a ton of great topics covered there. All kinds of issues that are important to libertarians, but then the occasional technical topic to bring you up to speed on things that you may not know about, but you don't know how to find out and you're too scared to ask, like what's a reverse repo, for example. That sort of thing is also covered. So a really great comprehensive site, and they are looking for contributors. So check it out at libertarianwingmedia.com. And if you don't remember that website when you get home, you can find it on the show notes page for this episode, which is tomwoods.com/562. Now, another libertarian website is Libertarian Tools, and the domain name is libertarianqa.com. And you're spelling out the word and. You're not using an ampersand. It's libertarianqanda.com. And again, as you can imagine, this is going to be a place where you can go and you've got some libertarian question and how do you answer it? Well, here's where you can find a clearinghouse of good answers for you. So libertarianqanda.com. Remember, if you're looking to start up that new blog, I give you all kinds of free stuff, a free overview of how to start it in just 5 minutes, and 24 free video tutorials, plus a free shout-out if you use my special affiliate link, and you'll also get the best pricing, too. So it's win-win-win, tomwoods.com/blue. Get all the details on how you get the free publicity and all that stuff. You got to write to me and tell me that you want it, because when you first start off a blog, you might not be ready yet. You have only one post. You're not ready for me to tell people about it. So make sure and write to me. But you'll find out exactly how to do all this, how to write to me, how to get the free publicity, all the free goodies at tomwoods.com/publicity. I link to that on every single show notes page. So read these show notes pages. All right. So what's the big thing that I'm telling you about? Well, I have an affiliate program for Liberty Classroom. Now, most of you know what an affiliate program is. A lot of times, for instance, I'll tell you it really helps me out, help me meet expenses if you use my Amazon affiliate link. If you shop through tomwoods.com/Amazon, it doesn't cost you anything extra, but it helps me keep the lights on here. I have an office and an assistant, and it really, really helps me. Well, that's an affiliate program. I don't produce the products that are for sale on Amazon. I don't have to create my own product. I basically sell other people's products. I lead you to other people's products through my Amazon link, and that's called an affiliate program. So I earn a fairly small commission through Amazon, but it's something. Well, I have an awesome affiliate program that makes Amazon look like nothing, because I don't just give you 4% or 5% or 7%. I give you 50%. What did I just say? Yes, 50% commissions are paid out in my affiliate program for libertyclassroom.com. So I issue you a special link that will track sales coming through that link, and I'll know that it's you who sent these people to me. So if you put this link up on Facebook or Twitter or on your blog or whatever, and you tell people about it, and they click on it, and they join, you get 50% of whatever they paid. So we have three different tiers of membership, so whatever they paid. So if they have a coupon, well, they paid a little less, but you get 50% of whatever they paid. So you can earn, if they get our master level, you can earn up to $248.50 per sale. Now, don't just put a link up on Facebook with no commentary. No one's going to buy that. You post a juicy post on your blog, or you give a little detail about it on Facebook, or you make a little screen capture video. You use something like Screencast-O-Matic, and you take people behind the scenes. Here's what Liberty Classroom looks like. Here's all the stuff they have. Here's what this site can do for you. It's a very high-quality product that you can promote with confidence, and that's serious dough. Now, remember, you have, I already told you guys can save money with coupons, libertyclassroom.com/coupons. But the retail price of these things is the low end is $89 a year, the somewhat higher end is $119, and the super-duper deluxe lifetime edition with all kinds of bonuses is $497 a year. If you get 50% of that, that is serious, serious dough. Now, you don't use it on your own subscription. That's what lowlifes do in the affiliate marketing world. That is a big no-no. You use it to bring in other people. That is serious money. There are all kinds of ways to do this. Let me tell you how you become an affiliate. If you're already a member of LibertyClassroom.com, you're already an affiliate. You're already a member of the program. Just check out account settings, and you'll see your special affiliate link. But if you're not, you can find out all the details at libertyclassroom.com/affiliate. You do not have to be a member of the site to join our affiliate program. libertyclassroom.com/affiliate. Be creative in how you promote it. As I say, make a YouTube video walking people through it. Or for the higher end memberships that we have, offer some kind of a bonus. Maybe you offer a couple of books. I mean, if you're going to earn almost $250 a sale, you can afford to give away a couple of books. Or if you have some kind of libertarian digital product of your own or an ebook or whatever that you can throw in as a free bonus if people join through your affiliate link, give them a reason to join through your link and you will get commissions. And I want you to stuff your pockets with affiliate commissions. I want you to earn a ton of dough through this program because the more successful you are, the more successful I am. Look around online. There are a lot of free tips if you Google them on how to be an effective affiliate, how to sell other people's products. I want you to sell this product. I want to pay you a 50% commission. So be creative. Figure out how to do it. It's easy to do. But figure out how to be especially clever in doing it to bring in sales for yourself and, frankly, for me. So that's my announcement. Because up to now, I haven't really pushed the affiliate program very much. We were giving away 30% commissions, and we didn't have these upper-tier levels of membership. Now we're giving away 50% commissions, and we have these higher-tier memberships that can bring in serious dough if you really apply yourself. So check it out, libertyclassroom.com/affiliate, and I'll see you tomorrow.